Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hi, this is Craig Garber, and before we get started, I just want to make a quick announcement and give you a little heads up. This particular episode where I interview Avi Bortnick from New York, we really got off track a little bit and wound up spending a lot of time talking about the side hustles that Avi has, probably more so than some of the music-related stuff. I didn't really take any of that out because I think one of the things that makes these conversations work is the organic nature of them. That being said, I just wanted to give you a heads up because some people may not be interested in that stuff. If you're one of them, I apologize. You know, once in a blue moon, a conversation goes like that. I thought a lot of people would also find it interesting to see what goes into some of these things and the apps that Avi's made and the process and the highs and the lows and the struggles. Because I think in music today, a lot of musicians, especially guitar players, are looking for side hustles. And quite frankly, with very rare exception, if you don't have plan B and usually plan C, D, and E right behind it, it's tough to make a living full-time as a musician. So anyway, just want to give you a heads up about that. And thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the episode and I will see you on the inside. Hey everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. In my pursuit to find every single guitar player in New York City and have them on this show, we're lucky enough to have another one today. Real class act with Avi Bortnick. Avi is best known for his long musical association with the influential jazz guitarist John Scofield. He plays rhythm guitar and electronics, composing and producing with John as well. He joined Scofield's Uber Jam band after auditioning upon a recommendation from Charlie Hunter, who's on this show in episode 236, back in 2000, and he played rhythm guitar and electronics on three records, Uber Jam, Up All Night, and Uber Jam, Did I say that right?
I believe so. That sounds like French to me.
Uber Jam Deux, D-E-U-X. If I said that wrong, let me know. He's also written, co-written numerous songs with John Scofield, and he produced, or co-produced rather, two of the three records. He also put out his own self-released instrumental record called Clean Slate in 2003. In addition to playing with John Scofield, he's played with his own groups, the Avi B3 and Ola, which features Joe Russo and Scott Metzger from the J-Rad, Joe Russo's Almost Dead band, and Scofield bandmate Andy Hess, who's known as the guitarist, bass player, and a wide range of other New York-based artists, including Jim Weider's Project Percolator, Eric Deutsch, Foro in the Dark, The Ghost Train Orchestra, Jihei, Renee Lopez, and Betty Black. When living in the San Francisco Bay Area, Avi played with Zigaboo Modaliste, Bobby McFerrin, What It Is, Jeff Norell, and Kotoja. He's known in musician circles for his rhythm guitar playing and his ability to blend in a variety of different musical configurations. In addition to his life as a guitarist, Avi's got some really interesting side gigs. He's an experienced acoustical consultant, and he's developed the apps called Time Guru Metronome, the Vox Beat Multi-Track Looper, and the Pitch Shifting Multi-Delay Looper app called Echo Pitch, and we'll talk about all of this today. Avi, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks.
So, you know, let's talk about your rhythm guitar, that you're a rhythm player, because you're most well known as for your association with Scofield and playing great rhythm. But you also play lead with the Avi B3 and your other projects. Now, I was curious if you could talk about that, you know, either not the differences, but, you know, maybe is there a different mindset you go into each one with, or is there one you prefer, or, you know, how that all came to be?
Well, I think it came to be because of my musical upbringing. I grew up in St. Louis, and I really started playing guitar in the 70s. And by the late 70s, I was already starting to play the music of the day. And that was rock, but it was also black funk music or R&B, whatever you want to call it. Hmm. And so that was just the function of guitar in that style of music, was to play that choppy rhythm guitar. And that was just in the air. It's the way other guitar players I knew played. And it was the way the guitar functioned in that music, like I mentioned. So to me, that's where I got adept at that style. And that just continued. So in the 80s, I played a lot of world beat music, Afrobeat and Caribbean music. And there again, the function of the guitar is that sort of 16th note based clean guitar sound.
Yes.
And then, you know, that was the time of Prince and a lot of other bands where the guitar player played like that. And then by the 90s, I was in funk bands that were kind of doing a rehash of some sort of version of 70s music. And then in 2000, I joined Sco's band playing that same style of rhythm guitar. But to me, it all traces back to the music from the 70s.
Very cool.
For some reason, it's just a style of guitar that has come sort of naturally or easiest to me. And Lord knows there's a lot of other things on the guitar that are really challenging and that I have to work on endlessly. But I don't put in a whole lot of effort to rhythm guitar. It just happened. And I'm not sure why that is.
Well, that's great, though. I think usually the things that are sort of organically natural, where you're not killing yourself to make it happen, you know, you tend to be successful in those areas, whether it's music or anything else.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder if it just boils down to individual physiology. Like some people, their joints are a little different or their cartilage is different, whatever goes into arm and finger motion, so that you're born able to do something more easily than someone else. Sort of like being a runner or something, or a basketball player.
Yeah.
If you're tall, have long. You know, maybe with guitar, the way someone's hand moves or the weight distribution in their hands and fingers is a little different, and you get this edge for certain things. I'm not really sure, but it definitely seems like some people are just able to do it more easily, and other people, no matter how much they practice, just aren't going to get it. Or maybe it has to do with the age in which you learn something, sort of like speaking without an accent. When you learn a new language, obviously, if it's too late in life, you'll always have an accent. But if you learn early enough, don't. And maybe it's that kind of thing where if you get something under your belt at a young age, it just sticks.
I think
you can do it.
I actually think physiology does have something to do that. I interviewed. Do you happen to know Corey Wong from Wolfpack?
Oh, yeah. He's great.
Yeah, and he's.
I don't know him personally, but yeah, he's great.
But he's got the same thing. You know, the funky thing going. And I was talking to him about that. And I think, I don't know if it was during the interview or afterwards, he picked up his guitar and he's moving his wrist back and forth. And he's like Gumby, man. I'm like, holy shit, what's going on there? Because it was literally like bouncing. And he goes, well, it's just my you know, basically the same thing he just said. It's my physiology is very easy for me to do that. And that's, I feel very comfortable and at home doing that.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised. How'd you wind up getting hooked up with Scofield back in 2000?
Well, Charlie Hunter is the main person who recommended me, although I think Sco got my name from different sources. At the time, John had this record out, or that was about to come out, called Bump. And on that record, he had overdubbed secondary guitar parts, some rhythm stuff, but also harmonies with the main melodies that he was playing. And just, it wasn't heavy guitar overdubs, but there was enough so that he was looking for someone to do a tour where they would play these secondary guitar parts and also play rhythm guitar. He wasn't looking for a second soloist. And he didn't want to have a keyboard player because on the record, it was all guitar. So he was basically looking for someone to do some a range of dates over a few months, and was asking people if they had any recommendations for someone who wouldn't mind not soloing and who would be up for playing these parts, but who also played good rhythm guitar. And so he got my name from Charlie, but I think he also got it from Lee Townsend, this producer that had worked with John a bunch. And Lee also knew me. And, I think maybe Charlie alerted me. I can't even remember. He said, hey, I put your name in with John Scofield, so he might call you. I'm like, what?
That dude is like Henry Kissinger. He has brokered, he has turned so many people onto like this, the same situation.
Yeah. So Charlie's just an incredible musician to me and a super guy. But I knew Charlie. We had never played together or anything, but I knew him from the Bay Area. And we actually had at least one community college ear training class together. That's when I first met him. And I didn't know who he was, and he didn't know that I was a guitar player or anything. We just were in the same class calling out intervals and all that. And I think Charlie was the best guy in the class. He just nailed it all the time. I also remember Charlie debating with the instructor about who plays better swing, Joe Pass or someone else. That's funny. Charlie was really opinionated about it then and really impressed me with his knowledge and his capability of arguing about jazz.
He's an extremely authentic human being. I'll tell you that much. Yeah, he's a really good
guy. Charlie had heard my band What It Is when he was on tour in Florida. And I think that even though I spent 20 years in the Bay Area and knew Charlie there, I don't know if he had ever heard my playing until he was on tour in Florida when I happened to be living there for grad school and heard my band What It Is. And I guess he was really impressed with my playing and it stuck in his mind. And then a few years after that, when Sko asked him about rhythm guitar, I guess I was the first guy who came to mind.
That's awesome.
So Charlie recommended me, and then Sko flew me to New York for an audition, and I just thought, well, this is silly. What am I doing flying to New York to audition with John Scofield? But hey, it sounds like an interesting experience. I'll get humiliated. I'll learn something and have my flight paid back to the Bay Area, and that'll be that. But much to my surprise, I got the gig.
So how did that whole thing go down? You just went for the audition. Did he call you right away or a week later or a day later? Or
no, I kind of knew it was going well within the first minute.
That's great.
Because I could tell by his face, and I knew I had prepped a lot too. What happened is John sent me the record before it came out. And said, these are the tunes we're going to do. And so he sent it to me probably a week before I came out. And in that week, I spent every moment I could trying to remember the stuff and also planning. Oh, yeah. He also said he wanted someone who was adept with effects, you know, who could make different sounds and be creative with effects. So I made this humongous pedal board in preparation for this. It was kind of ridiculous. It was so huge. And but I had mapped out, okay, on this song, I'm going to step on this combination of pedals. And so it was all worked out. So I was really prepared. And when I came to the audition, it was clear that I was the most prepared guy.
I was going to say, do you know how much initiative that is and how far that goes? My God.
Well, I mean, I was scared. You know, I just thought I'm going to be humiliated either way. And I want to be less as minimally humiliated as possible. So I better do everything I can to just be prepared.
That's awesome, man. I think that's freaking really amazing that you did all that.
And I didn't know, but the band that I was auditioning with hadn't really formed yet. So it was, I think they had played once or twice together, but it wasn't the band on the record. So the other guys didn't know the music all that well. And I think it was John hadn't played those tunes in months. So he was trying to remember it. And I felt like, wow, I feel like I know this music better than anyone here.
You probably did.
And I probably did. So I felt, as soon as things started and I heard other people making mistakes and not being able to remember stuff and I felt more relaxed.
Yeah.
So I knew it was going pretty well. And then basically the audition turned into a rehearsal. So rather than just being, oh, we're going to play for half an hour, it turned into, I don't know, 6 hours or something. And in the break, John just said, I'd really like you to do this. We have these dates. And that was that.
You didn't say, you didn't like do the positioning things like I got to talk to my manager and see if we're available.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so. That's awesome.
I was completely stunned, and it's kind of funny because words. I don't think I told people in the Bay Area. I didn't tell a lot of musician friends because A, I didn't want to have to say, no, I didn't get the gig. And B, if I did get the gig, I didn't want people's incredulousness or envy. So because I felt like I was a jazz imposter. And here I was flying to New York to play with one of the best jazz guitar players of our era. And then when I got the gig, I remember telling people, and I could see their jaws drop when I said that I was going to be playing with John Scofield, because a lot of people knew me as a good rhythm guitar player, but not as a jazz player. And I think people assumed that if I was playing with John Scofield, we were going to be playing deep jazz.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's interesting you say that because I have felt like that about myself at certain times in my life. But so I'm going to say something out loud for my own benefit. And if you get something out of it, that'll be awesome. But I think if someone says something positive and if a bunch of people say something positive about you, it's got to be true. You know, and it's just like accept it gracefully. And again, I'm not advising you. I'm saying this out loud for me. You know, yeah. Accept it gracefully and – you know, humbly, and thank you, and keep doing that. So
I should also mention at the time that I got the call, I actually wasn't gigging very much. I had already started working in acoustics, so I had that job, and I had a few gigs a month, but it wasn't like I was really on the scene. I almost felt like I was retiring from the scene. Then all of a sudden everything got rejuvenated and resuscitated by this opportunity to play with Sco. In any case, that was in 2000. It was only supposed to be a few months of dates, but it morphed into something else, and John really liked the sound of two guitars and the concept of that band. So it just kept on going, and it still technically goes on now, even though we're not playing this year.
Man, that's a great story. And it's from my perspective, what you just said, you really earned that thing 100%. I would have been thrilled. Some guy come out to my audition, built a pedal board, and with the diligence you put into knowing the songs, that's like, you know, it's almost like if the guy's not even the best guy available, that's the guy you want, because he can make himself the best guy available. The guy puts in that kind of effort. So that's awesome, man. Congratulations. Yeah. Well earned.
I think also, I never really talked with Sco about this, but I think I picked up on it, that I know he had auditioned several other guitar players who are all really great players. I know who they are, most of them anyway. And I think I was able to not step on him in the way other guitar players were, I suppose. I think it's partially my approach and sound are very different from his, but also that I'm not interested, or I certainly wasn't interested in playing solos in his band. I mean, you can't top it, so what am I going to do? You know, he plays a solo, and then it's going to be me, and it just feels kind of ridiculous and also redundant to have that much guitar playing. Oh, actually, that's one of the things John said to me in that break at the audition. I said, I really like you to do this, but I have to tell you, I'm going to be the one who's soloing and you'll play rhythm guitar. I'll give you space to do things, but it's going to be me playing the solos. Is that okay? It's like, yeah.
No, but it's good that, you know what? It's great that he clarified it, because you might have a guy coming in there thinking, oh man, I'll get to do some solos.
Exactly,
you know,
yeah.
No, I think that's very smart of him to clarify that, just to, you know, to make sure you're okay with it. Because if you're not, then you're not the guy. It's not a fit for either one of you.
Yeah, and I want to play to my strengths. I don't want to be cast in a situation where I'm asked to do things that I don't think I sound good doing.
Yeah.
So I think I sound good playing rhythm guitar. I don't think I'd sound great playing solo. So, yeah, let's focus on the strengths here.
I agree with that, man. Hey, you mentioned a few minutes ago you do some work as an acoustical consultant.
Yeah.
What does that mean exactly? And so what do you do and who do you do it for, the kind of clients?
It basically boils down to sound and sound in buildings. So mostly I work with architects and developers who are making new buildings or renovating buildings. And when I say sound, mostly it's pretty unrelated to music. It's a lot of sound isolation, noise control of mechanical equipment, meaning the ventilation systems and elevators that go into a building, because all that stuff makes noise. And mostly it's apartment buildings and office projects, occasionally recording studios. I've worked on several New York nightclubs. So it's anything related to sound and noise control. I've done outdoor noise studies too. As you know, New York is a very, very noisy place. So there's
a little bit
noise issues. Also, noise is the biggest generator of complaints to the hotline, the 311 line.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. So it's basically dealing with everyday sound rather than music sound. And it's not very related in its thought process to music. It's more about, there's some calculations involved, but when you've been doing it for a while, you calculate less and less. It's kind of like being a doctor or something where you just know stuff. You don't have to consult your manual.
Hmm. So I would imagine the architects bring you in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. your relationship is with architects and
right.
Yeah. Okay. It's interesting. How did you get into that? Cause it's not like, I mean, did you take classes in this or was this a career you trained for? Cause it's pretty specific.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very specific and it's a very small field. I know a majority of the people who work in the field, I would say, in New York, or have met them. You know, it's really a small group. But I got into it upon a suggestion by my dad, who was an architect. And I think my dad was never very comfortable with me being a musician. And I think he also sensed that I was looking for something else to do. I worked only as a musician for many years in the Bay Area, and I was playing weddings and Mexican restaurants and kind of the normal hustle of a working guitar player, just driving around to gigs. And it felt a little like I was on a treadmill. It didn't feel like I was really advancing as a guitar player. I wasn't really advancing in career terms. I was just doing the same thing and it was getting stale. So he knew that I was trying to figure out what else there is to do in life. And he thought that maybe I'd be interested in architectural acoustics because it's related to sound. Then I looked into it and it was interesting to me. And then I looked around for schools where you could learn this in a structured way. And I found out that the University of Florida in Gainesville was one of the few places where you could study architectural acoustics. And then I applied and got in there and studied there. Oh, I'd also taken a lot of supplementary math and science classes at a community college, along with the ear training classes where I met Charlie Hunter.
Oh.
So after graduating my undergraduate degree, which has nothing to do with acoustics or music, it was Latin American studies. I went to UC Berkeley. After graduating and deciding I wanted to go study acoustics, I realized that I needed to beef up my math and science skills. So I went to a community college, got a math degree from there, and that fulfilled prerequisites to go study in graduate school.
Wow. What were you going to do, if you don't mind, with a degree in Latin American studies? Are you planning on going abroad or something? I mean, just curious.
I had no idea.
I was really into this. I was really into Spanish chicks at the time, so I thought that was a good move.
That's not that far from it. I lived in Brazil for a while and had a Brazilian girlfriend. But I was really into Brazilian music, actually.
Okay.
And so there was actually a music connection to that. But, you know, it was a liberal arts degree. It's a little bit arbitrary whether you study English or rhetoric or Latin American studies or history or political science. It's a degree, you know. It's the main thing is to finish it and say you're able to do something and you learn how to write. Honestly, I think that's the biggest skill that I learned in as an undergraduate is having my papers worked over, come back with red marks all over it, getting sensitive to writing.
Right.
That was the biggest takeaway, and that's served me well as an acoustical consultant because you have to write a lot. And there's also something similar to me between good writing and composing. When you're writing music, a lot of times it's deciding what to take out, what's unnecessarily complicated, what is excessive, what doesn't fit with something else. And with writing, it's very similar. You have to be economical. You have to say things in a straightforward way. Well, you don't have to, but that's what constitutes good writing.
Yeah. Verbose
ramblings. So there's a focus on economy and clarity, and those are things that I value in composing too.
Yeah, for sure. You probably don't know this, but I've written ad copy for the last 20 years. That's how I've made the bulk of my living. And yeah, economy and direct and clarity and simplicity, right. All that stuff is, you know, the most important.
Do you write music too?
No, I do not write music at all. Yeah. But
you probably have though, right?
Yeah, I have in the past. Yeah, I have.
Yeah. I don't know. For me, there's a real link between those two. And also, in some ways, a similar feeling when you nail a great sentence or a paragraph or something. It's like, wow, I really like the way that flows. Or you edit something. It's like, oh, that's so much better. That happens with writing too, when it's like, oh, this is a much better way to go to the bridge. Or I love how comes out of the bridge, or this is a little novel, but it's simple.
The iambic pentameter, you know, the meter of what you're saying. It's huge, man. It's very, and it's funny because and my wife probably hates me for this, but you know, she runs a business. She's a real estate agent, and actually she's a broker now. But and she'll have me to look at her email sometimes. It's like, I feel bad because I'm like, nope. Because, you know, you said the same word in two separate sentences. She said, so what? I'm like, no, you don't want to do that. It messes up the meter.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, simplicity, clarity. That's why I my favorite guitar player is David Gilmour. Primarily because of his economy. I mean, he's the most economical guy I've ever heard. You know, he says so much with so few notes. It turns me on, man. So, okay. So acoustical consultant, that's really interesting, man. That sounds like a real cool gig. And it's also like, I would imagine that is totally recession proof.
Not really. You know why? Because it's
building
connected to construction.
Yeah. Development.
And in the 2008, 2009 era, when construction in New York almost halted, it seemed like. Architects were out of work. Acoustical consultants followed them. So there was a real dip. It's not exactly recession-proof. You can sort of morph into other things. Like now people, rather than working on new buildings, the work goes into either renovations or minor sound isolation issues that people are having in their apartments. But by and large, it's not really recession-proof. Even though there's a demand for it, people can't pay for it. So.
Well, here's what you do, man. The next time there's a slowdown, you find out all the lawsuits that have gone down like in Manhattan, and you send out a letter. It says, hey, you know what? Have you protected yourself? Are you insulated from these kinds of lawsuits? And then that's your lead generation letter. Let's do a sound audit of your building to make sure you don't get sued.
There's codes that people need to meet for acoustics, and that does happen where people test their building and they find it doesn't meet the acoustical codes, and then people start pointing fingers, and then pretty soon lawyers are involved.
That's right. But if you just hire you to do an audit, then you're fine. Yeah. Let's talk about your apps, because this I find really interesting. You've developed three apps.
Mm-hmm. The first one is Time Guru. It's a fancy metronome. Mm-hmm. And the main novel feature with Time Guru is that it'll cut out randomly. In other words, the sound gets muted, so it leaves you on your own while you're practicing, and then the beat or the click comes back in, so you can assess whether you're rushing or dragging, what your tendency is. So the idea is, rather than having a constant metronome click to keep you in line time-wise, it mutes or drops out so that you have to feel the time internally. So it's a way to develop your internal sense of time. I think a normal metronome that's always going, you tend to rely on that external source rather than internalizing the time feel.
That's interesting. What made you come up with apps in the first place? I mean, do you coding, or did you hire someone to do your coding, or like, did you just spot a need in the app? Did you need one of these apps yourself? And you said, this does not exist. Let me create it.
Yeah, it's more the latter, but I'll try to give you a short answer to all of it. So for years, I had thought about this metronome concept, and I wondered why no one made a metronome, a physical metronome, you know, a little battery-operated box with a randomized mute function or a dial or something where you could tell the metronome to not always click, but sometimes click silently. So maybe you'd still have a light, but you wouldn't hear the click. And it baffled me that no one made this. So I actually looked into making hardware boxes like manufactured in China or something. Mm-hmm. But I had no idea how to go about getting something manufactured or prototype. It seemed like such an uphill battle that I just forgot about it. And what I would do is just program a sequencer on my computer or drum machine to click, but then have silent measures or silent randomly almost or pseudo-random silences. So I would do that on my own for practicing. And then what happened is when iPhones or smartphones came out, it's like, wow, here's a hardware box, and you can just program it to do anything. So I thought, this is solved. I don't need to figure out who's going to manufacture the box. Now it's just about coding it. And so I looked into finding a programmer who'd implement this concept. So I came out with the layout and what all the buttons needed to do and what functions there were going to be. And through some freelancer coding websites where you can hire people to work, I hired a programmer. And at the time, I knew nothing about coding. And I also figured that it would be too hard to learn how to program in a time efficient way. In other words, it would take me years to learn how to do what I wanted to do. And at that point, the game would be over, that someone else would come up with this or I would lose interest. So I wanted to get this done quickly. So rather than learn how to do it myself, I just hired someone. And there turns out there's all these websites where you can hire freelance programmers from around the world, and a lot of them work for ridiculously cheap.
Which one did you wind up going with?
At that time, it was freelancer.com.
But
there's Upwork? There's different ones. There's Upwork.
Yeah.
There's Guru, Upwork. I think Upwork used to be called Elance.
Correct.
But then what happened, it's kind of interesting. I hired this guy who happened to be in Poland, and he was really enthusiastic and found it to be a big relief not have to be coding for databases. And he thought it would be really interesting to do something like this, which was music related. And he was so enthusiastic and did a great job, but there was one fundamental problem. The metronome didn't keep good time. He kept sending me prototypes to test, and all the functions were fine, but the click was unsteady. And I don't know if non-musicians would notice it, but if you're trying to practice to it, you notice it immediately.
Well, yeah, even if they don't, it's kind of like the antithesis of what everything you're trying to put together.
Yeah, right. So the main function was faulty. Yeah. And he kept trying to adjust it and trying different things and would send it back to me. And I kept saying no. And it was finally, I had to pull the plug. And it's like, I need to find someone else because I want to get this done. And he seemed unable to solve this fundamental problem. So then I took a different approach. I thought, well, I know there's people out there who've done metronomes. Let me find someone who's done a good one and see if I can hire them. So what I did is I downloaded pretty much every metronome you could find for the iPhone at that point. This was 2011. Mm-hmm. So the iPhone was, or 2010 rather. The iPhone was fairly new at that point. Wait, was it end of 2010. You know, the iPhone had been out for a few years, but at the time, I think there were 400,000 apps out. Now there's well over a million. It's grown tremendously. But there were probably 30 metronomes. Now there's, I don't know, 200 or something. So I downloaded a bunch of them, and I fed the click into Pro Tools and looked at which ones were lining up properly with the grid and which ones weren't. And it turned out there were a lot that didn't keep good time.
So this must be a problem inherent in coding.
Yeah.
That only a few people figured out how to solve.
Right. And it turns out, which I found out later, about half of the metronomes available at that time were recycling the same code that Apple had actually put out.
Yep.
So Apple had put out sample code as a guide to developers. And the idea of the sample code was something along the lines of, this is how you sync an image with sound. So you get a flashing light bulb and then a sound that goes along with it. Well, Apple never intended that to be a steady metronome. It was just kind of a good enough approximation of syncing sound with a visual cue. And people took that sample code and slapped their own graphics, like a picture of a pendulum or something like that. Or just a flashing bulb or whatever, and put it out and sold it as metronomes. Well, they didn't keep good time. So, but some metronomes were really steady. And I found a guy who had done a metronome that I thought was very clever called Mitronome. And I found the guy on Facebook and wrote to him. I said, listen, I've started this project and the previous developers having trouble making the metronome have steady time. I'm wondering if you'd be interested in helping out. He wrote back immediately, and he knew me from the Schofield band because this guy's a guitar player too.
Wow.
So he was really excited to work with me because he had heard me play in New Orleans.
That's so cool.
And it's a young guitar player, Adam Bellard, who's actually a great guitar player, now lives in New York, but he's an incredible software developer too, which is his main gig. You know, he plays around town, but he's a programmer par excellence. So Adam knew exactly what was wrong with the metronome as it existed. And he said, yeah, they're just recycling Apple's code. You can't do that. You need to, I think his terminology was rebuild the audio engine or something like that, which I didn't know what he meant, but I trusted that he knew what he meant. And so he redid it, and voila, it was completely steady. I put it into Pro Tools, let it play for hours, and it just remained steady. It just did not deviate. So Adam was really the main guy who helped me with that.
Hold on one second. But he had a competing product, though.
Well, it wasn't competing enough. First of all, I think he wasn't really interested in becoming, having his metronome be his retirement fund or something. He did it as a cool project. And also the whole random mute function was novel. So, and also the way my metronome is structured, it's really easy to set up sequences of different meters. So let's say you have a bar of 4/4, but then it's followed by a bar of 3/8 and a bar of 5/4, something like that. It's really easy to implement that in my metronome, which was also a novel aspect. So there was enough differentiation.
Okay.
That it
you weren't competing against each other.
Yeah. I mean, technically it's all metronome, but all these metronomes do different things.
Sure.
Different strengths. And mine has like voice count if you want it, and all these other things that were different enough. And also I think for him, it was a gig, you know, I was going to pay him and, he was interested.
Man, there's so many, I want to hear about the other two metronomes, the other two apps you have, but there's so many good lessons in there. Like number one, the simple fact that you're smart enough to say, okay, I need to hire someone else because, you know, I'm not going to learn this time or efficiency wise to get it done. And I think that's a big problem. A lot of people either don't want to spend the money or they want to own and control everything. And that's always causes a problem.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's no different than getting a roofer. I mean, you can learn how to fix your roof. I'm sure if you go on Google, you could learn that. But who the hell wants to do that? And how much time is it going to take? And it's, you quote save money, but how much does it cost you in time and then to fix it again the right way?
Yeah, exactly.
And
I mean, I would love to know how to code. I'd love to be able to be independent and just do everything myself. Just like I'd love to be a drummer and, you know, play my own music, but it'll just, I need a few lifetimes to do that.
Right.
Who's got that kind of time?
It's just not realistic. It's like, you
know. Not realistic.
No.
And plus, you know what? It's actually more fun to collaborate with people. You get the human interaction.
Yep.
Who wants to live in their own bubble and be completely self-contained? So it actually would have been less happy learning how to code and keeping it all to myself and trying to figure it all out myself. And it was much better to collaborate with someone and joke around about stuff and also have someone else contribute ideas. That
bingo, that's what I was about to say. You wouldn't have had that done because the brain power of the two of you, you know, was far greater than, you know, what either one of you could have done alone. That's where that value comes in.
And then Adam helped me out. He did the coding on my second app too, which is called VoxBeat. And that, again, he had incredible ideas for that.
What does that app do?
That the novel thing about that app, and this is another thing, I only do apps where it's an idea that I feel like other people have not done. And that's the first stage where I research and see if has anyone done anything similar to this. So VoxBeat, the novel thing about that is you beatbox, in other words, sing a beat,
right,
mouth a beat, and it analyzes which part of that beat that comes out of your mouth corresponds with the kick drum, snare drum, and hi-hat. So boom, tots, boom, you know, something simple like that. Of course, if you listen to that, you know which is kick, snare, and hi-hat. So if your brain can determine that, maybe it's possible to design an app that will decode that. So we tried different approaches. Oh, and so the idea is it decodes it, and then it assigns drum samples to those parts of your beatboxing, the kick, snare, and hi-hat. So you sing a beat, it records it, it decodes it, and then separates the kick, snare, and hi-hat sounds and assigns drum samples to that. Now you can freely change those sounds. So, oh, I want a different kick sound or a different snare sound, just like a drum machine. So it's a way of programming a drum machine by singing the beat rather than tapping into it.
Oh, wow. Okay. Very cool. Yeah, it totally makes sense. Now, you know, there. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, you go ahead.
I like doing what you did. I like trying to find a market gap.
Yeah.
In something. And I think I did that with this show. And this is the first time I've done that successfully. And I've been working for myself for 20 years. That being said, the devil's advocate corollary to that is if a bunch of people are doing something and making money at it, it means the marketplace is open for that. And so then all you need to do is make your widget different within that already existing marketplace, which is much easier than coming up with something, you know, a brand new sort of thing that doesn't exist.
Yeah, that there's merit in that too.
Yeah.
But I guess with that, you just have to make sure that the market is wide enough to absorb yet another player.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But in any case, I thought this was a pretty nifty concept.
Very cool, man.
To implement it would be really cool. So Adam and I came up with different concepts for how we could implement this in software, different approaches. Like, would it be word recognition, much like dictation? So, and actually the original name for the project was Beatbox Dictaphone. So we were going to beatbox it, but it was going to transcribe your beatboxing. So the first approach that I think we tried was to look at actual word recognition. So the boom was a kick sound, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you said boom, that was just like a word, and that would mean kick. Well, that didn't work out that well. It was just a slow process and error prone and all that. And maybe you don't want to say boom, you want to say buh or whatever.
Sure.
We needed it to be more foolproof than that. So in the end, what we did was a combination of frequency analysis. So figuring out what's the high frequency sound and what's the low frequency sound. With a combination of basically vowel analysis.
Wow. So,
which is also known as formants. So, because if you think about it, you can't really do frequencies, because what if it's a female versus a male voice? The male is much lower in frequency than the female, but we need to have a way to recognize what is a kick sound.
Sure.
Versus a hi-hat sound. And a female will be shifted in frequency, so it can't just be a pure frequency analysis. So it has to be something along the lines of vowel analysis, which is what our brains do. If a female says ah versus a male ah, it both sounds like ah to our brains, even though if you put it in a scope, it'll be shifted in frequency. So basically what's going on is it looks at the frequency, but also looks at the vowel shape.
Wow.
And you can also train it to recognize your own voice. In any case, so that was the original idea, was to be a beatbox dictaphone. But then it was like, well, it'd be cool to just add some audio tracks to this also, so you could program a beat really quickly and then sing or play audio against it. So it's a multi-track recorder with a drum machine function where you can program the drum machine by singing the beat if you want to. You can also tap on the screen, much like a, it's not exactly a step sequencer, but it's sort of like MIDI pulses on a screen. You can tap where the hi-hat and kick drum and snare should go. You can also correct it if it gets your beatboxing wrong, which it will do. And the more complicated your beatboxing, the more wrong it is, or the more errors come up. So I thought that would be a lot more successful than it's turned out to be. It didn't become the hot seller that I envisioned.
Sure.
So you win some, you lose some, but it's out there and it's kind of cool and some people like it. It needs some work. It's not really buggy, but every once in a while it screws up and you have to restart the app. And I'm not sure why, and Adam is too busy to deal with it, and the code behind it is too complicated to hire someone else. So at this point it's just out there, somewhat abandoned. I'm not really putting in any update work. But the nice thing is that as hardware gets faster, the app works better. Because originally, I think when we did this, the new phone was the iPhone 5.
Oh, wow.
And now, of course, we're up to the 10, and the processing time is much, much reduced. So it's pretty nifty now. You sing your beat, and almost immediately afterwards, it gets decoded and broken down into kick, snare, and hi-hat. So that's that app. So I hope I didn't drone on for too long about it.
Well, no, there's something that you said, though, is also really important about, you know, I thought it would do better than it would. I would say, like, probably, you know, for most of the projects I've been involved with, if you get one out of three or one out of four, you know, that's probably a little more realistic of what's going to happen. People seem to think that everything that people do is like works. That's totally 100% not true.
But it also, if you think about it, the metronome is very successful. Fox beat in terms of sales, not so much. But every musician needs a metronome. Not every musician is interested in having a way to jot down their ideas, because a lot of musicians either don't compose or have some other method or are not interested in this little app as a way of jotting down their ideas, which is basically what Voxbeat is. It's a way of putting down ideas really quickly. So you get a drum beat, you can make some audio tracks against it, and voila, you've captured your idea with a beat.
Sure.
So, but not every musician is interested in that, whereas every musician needs to practice, and most people who practice eventually practice with a metronome.
Yeah, whether they're guitar players or trumpet players, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. So the market is 10 times bigger.
Oh, it's infinitely bigger. It's evergreen.
Yeah.
Do you actively market that, or do you just let...
You have to initially. The app world is interesting as far as marketing, because most of the time it's not cost effective to take out magazine ads.
Oh, no, not at all.
No, it just costs way too much money. So what I did initially, I did a few things. One, I tried to get reviews in different music magazines.
Okay.
And I had a little bit of an advantage in that I knew people who worked at these magazines from doing interviews with them.
Great.
For years. So I just
hold on a second. People. Let me just explain one thing. A magazine is something that used to come out every month. And this, it was about a topic, in this case about music, and you'd actually do this other dirty four-letter word, read this magazine, and it would be informative and interesting. Sorry.
I'm glad you clarified that. It was also on paper.
Yes.
But anyway, so I got reviews in Guitar Player and I think Sound on Sound and some other magazines. And then, of course, also there's online publications. So I'd send around promo copies of the app and with a little blurb about it and say, you know, I'd really appreciate it if you could mention it or write a review.
Sure.
And it was, that was by far the most effective marketing technique. When a review would appear, I would see the sales just shoot up.
Wow.
Another thing I did is I sent emails to hundreds of music instructors at different universities.
Oh, that's clever.
Yeah. Because I figured, well, who would be most interested in this? It's musicians and people teaching music. And people teaching music have lots of students. So if you get instructors talking about it, then probably the students will download it.
Yep.
So I sent around a lot of emails. You know, I'd figure out like the structure of emails. And it's always like at blah, blah, blah dot edu. Right. And usually it's the first initial and last name or something like that. And I just figured out, then I'd look on the website and see all the different instructors. And then I just knew the structure of the email and would send it out. Of course, it was like a form email. I just type in their names. So that helped. But mostly it was reviews that really get that ball rolling. And then afterwards, you really don't have to do that much. It kind of takes on a life of its own. Where it shows up in the app searches and there are reviews in the App Store, or Time Guru is also an Android app, so on Google Play you can see the reviews. And once you get enough good reviews, then it kind of takes care of itself and you really don't need to do much in the way of marketing. I mean, you can, but it's diminishing returns at that point, because mostly you just need those reviews in the App Store.
So So you have to do something. You got to get it launched, in other words, to get it to get some momentum. Okay, I gotcha. How much time, or as each iOS, and I guess now on the Android side, changes, how much time is needed to update the code?
Not that much. These are pretty simple apps. They just live on your phone. They don't tap into a central server or anything like that. So not that much needs to change. Although I think when it went, there was one Apple update that broke things that we had it to fix. And I forget which one that was. But that was the only time where things got screwed up because of an update. And otherwise, you know, when every update comes out, I kind of hold my breath and test it. And then if it works, it's like, great, I don't have to do anything. But, you know, we've had a lot of updates, especially to Time Guru, where I've thought of new features to add. For instance, when it first came out, you couldn't save presets. It's like, well, that's a necessity, so put out an update. And I've changed the graphics a little bit along the way, which I do myself.
So Adam works with you on some of this, and then you do some of this on your own?
Yeah, yeah. So I've learned how to get in there and tinker. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of trial and error, where I figure, well, I get into the code and I do word searches to try to find things, and I just look at what the code says and what the values are, and it's like, oh, well, maybe I'd like to increase the BPM range, and I find that function or something, and then I just bump it up. So I've learned a little bit, but I'm not a programmer really, but I'm comfortable getting in there and tinkering around for some things. So some of the updates I do on my own, but I've also hired people for minor updates, someone else to do an iPad specific layout. Yeah.
That's cool. And the last one, you have Echo Pitch?
Yeah. That's with another musician programmer who lives in Greece, Max Kaliakatos. He's really fantastic. He teaches software coding in Greece, but he's also a really great guitar player. And that's one thing I found, is that for music apps, it's so helpful if the programmer knows about music. When you have to try to explain what an eighth note is to someone.
Oh, God, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah.
You know, you have to think about it in mathematical terms, and it's challenging. So, and that was a problem with the first programmer with Time Gurus. I'd say, you know, no, the eighth, it has to do an eighth note or a 16th note. So, well, what is that? It's like, well, I won't get into that, but
yeah, it's got to be difficult. There's going to be no passion there too. If someone's a musician, they're going to be at least enthusiastic about it as well, which that's you know, they're going to be willing to bring the pedal board to the audition like you did.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so, and that's important.
Yeah. So Max and I developed this app that is also novel. And we had a few different ideas of things to do, and I thought this would be really cool. It's a delay unit, but it has five delays that cascade. Well, four delays are in parallel, cascading into another delay that's in series. So it feeds a delay, but the novel thing is that each repeat can be pitched up or down in half steps. So most echoes, you get a delay signal that's identical to what you put into it. This, the repeat can be a different pitch. So by playing one note, you get another note back on repeat, right? Well, if you do several delays at once, you play a note and now you get a harmony back. So you can structure it to say, well, I'm going to play a C note, but the repeats are going to be E and G.
Oh, wow.
So now you get a harmony out of that one note, right?
So this is like a pedal that you hook up through your phone?
Ideally you need an interface, and there's many small audio interfaces that are designed to work with iPhones through the Lightning cable. So you plug in your guitar, for instance, to the interface plugs into the phone, and it's basically just like you would if you were plugging into a laptop or a desktop computer. You need a way to get sound in, right? But phones are nothing more than shrunken computers. So in this case, the delay or the app, it processes audio that you get into the phone, preferably through an interface. You don't have to do that. You could just use the microphone on the phone. The problem with that is that the speaker is next to the microphone, so you start getting feedback, which is not great. So it's better to either use headphones or an interface or something like that. So that's how it's designed to work. But it'll also work as a plug-in in other apps. So, for instance, you can have GarageBand on your phone or your iPad and then pull this in as a plug-in for GarageBand or some other audio app. So it's compatible with that to just kind of work as a plug-in. And then you can process audio and come up with all kinds of trippy, spirally, cascading delay sounds that are pitched, right? So it's a little hard to explain. Every time a non-musician asks me what this app does, I kind of just want to change the subject.
You should. Do you have videos explaining it? You could just direct them to a video.
But it's. I think it's super cool, and it sounds amazing, and you can do all kinds of trippy ambient swirls with it, and it's really fun and very easy to create interesting sounds and experimental textures and all that. Oh, it also works as a harmonizer. If you set the delay time to zero, now all of a sudden you've got four different potential harmonies. So you could play one note and then have four other notes play along with it.
Did you get the idea from that, from your work with Schofield, with the sounds?
That's a good question. Let me think about that for a second, because I'm trying to remember which came first. Maybe, you know, one thing I do a lot of laptop processing of my guitar with Schofield. So
I saw that on video. That's why I prompted that question.
Yeah. So I can't remember when I started doing that. I don't know if it was after this app or what, but it's a concept that I thought about a while ago, and I don't honestly remember which came first, but I thought, oh, it'd be really cool to pitch shift the delay. So rather than just a repeat of the note you play, you get a different note back. And that's one of the things I do in Sco's band. So I use Ableton Live, and I've got all these different programmed effects that you can't find in a pedal. So that's one of them, where you play a note and maybe you get a note that's a fifth above from that note. So it's a little bit like a harmonizer, but harmonized delay. So it's one of the things I do in that band. And I can't remember if we started the app before I started doing that, or if I started doing that before the app. I'm not sure. But in my mind, they're sort of similar, or my thought process is related about what would be cool to do with audio that no one else has done, or at least to my knowledge, people haven't done.
So the other nice thing about all this is, all you guys that are musicians out there that are looking for side hustles, Avi just talked you through three of them. So, you know, I don't think it's realistic that anybody in music today, with rare exception, is making money only one way. And even top guys are doing other stuff like information products and lessons and loads of things like that, endorsements. So, I mean, you know, the only limit here is, you know, your own limits. So that's pretty good, and it's inspirational, I think.
Yeah, I should say, for anyone who wants to get into this world and they're not a coder, there is a steep learning curve for learning how to interface with Apple. In other words, let's say you develop an app. Okay, that's fine. Now what? Well, you have to get it to Apple, and they have to review it. And there's all these security hurdles you have to go through so that Apple knows that the person who's collecting the revenue is really you, that the person who's uploading the update is really you, that your app doesn't have malicious code or doesn't violate privacy norms. And so it gets complicated, and there's a lot of jargon that you have to learn. And so initially, when Time Guru first came out, I think it took me a week to figure out how to upload it to Apple. It was so confusing. And even Adam, the coder, said, you know, I can figure out how to program, but for the life of me, I get stumped every time I have to try to interface with Apple. They've simplified it a lot, so it's a lot better now. But initially, it was really challenging. But still, anyone who has an app idea, you're going to have to put in a lot of time somewhere along the line, even if you hire a coder to do everything. If it's you that's going to be in charge of the app, you have to learn at least some functions of Xcode, which is the programming environment for iPhone apps.
No, well, that's why, and you're better off working with someone who's done this already.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of what they're bringing to the table is the learning curve of, you know, you don't have to do this.
Yeah. I think this is turning into everyone loves apps.
Right? Everyone loves apps. Yes. Anyway, let's move on, man. I want to talk about, you've mentioned that you grew up in St. Louis, but I know you also lived in San Fran and now you live in New York. So, like, where'd you grow up? Where are you originally from?
Well, I was actually born in Israel. But that doesn't have much to do with anything, but it's where I was born. My parents left when I was about 18 months old. And my mom's from Turkey. My dad's American, but they happened to be living in Israel when I was born. Then they came back to the U.S. And, yeah, I grew up in St. Louis. I went to public schools there through high school, finished high school there. And the subdivision that I grew up in is called University City. And the community at that time, I guess, really valued the arts and music. So we had really great music teachers, really great music classes, a really good jazz band and orchestra. And so I played in those. And I think a lot of times when people talk about musical influences, people cite famous people. Well, for me at that time, the really strong musical influences were other people in my school.
That's
other
great.
Guitar players watch and think, wow, they're really fantastic. And you learn from them because they're so immediate. You can watch them up close and hear them up close. So that was very formative, I think.
I think that's very common or not uncommon in the Midwest, because you're not the first guy I've spoken to who said that. That is fairly common in the Midwest, actually.
Yeah. So, so I grew up in St. Louis. I took lessons when I was 7 years old, taking guitar lessons at a local music store, and bailed on that. Well, I switched to classical guitar with someone at Washington University, Alan Rosenketter, a really great classical player. But by the time I was 11 or so, I had stopped playing guitar. And I started playing piano. So I studied classical piano from 12 to 18. And oddly enough, I didn't start really getting serious about guitar till I stopped taking lessons.
So you went back to guitar after classical piano? Is that what you're saying? Or?
Well, I played classical piano while I was practicing guitar. But funny enough, I didn't start practicing guitar for real until I stopped taking lessons, because now I was untethered and I could just practice the music I liked rather than staid classical and Renaissance pieces.
Gotcha.
You know, and as a young kid, you want to play the music that your friends and that you like. And classical wasn't so much on the radar. I wanted to play REO Speedwagon and Leonard Skinner and later on the funk music that I grew to like. So I started learning chords and practicing and learning songs and figuring out the blues scale and practicing that. And then I became more and more into it. And then I got my first electric guitar when I was 13. And, I took lessons with a really great guitar player in St. Louis later on, this guy, Peter Mayer. So that was St. Louis. I feel like that's where I learned most of what I know.
Pretty stable childhood. Sound like you had pretty normal background.
Yeah.
You have any brothers or sisters?
Yeah, I have a brother and a sister.
Oh, wow.
But they're not musicians. They took piano lessons, but I was the one who gravitated towards music.
Where are you on the pecking order? The first, second, oldest, youngest?
Yeah, oldest.
Okay. When did you like decide, okay, this is what I need to do for a career now?
Well, it's a funny thing. I never tried to be a professional musician. Well, I half tried, I guess. In high school, I had the experience of seeing the Pat Metheny group when I was 16.
Mm-hmm.
And I was completely blown away. I loved Pat Metheny. I knew his music really well. I transcribed his solos and started to sound like a really cartoonish version of Pat Metheny. And so I was a total Pat Metheny freak. Then I saw him live and I realized he was so good and wasn't that much older. I think he was like probably 24 or something at the time. So he was young enough to feel like this is a place where I can envision, or this is an age. Let me restate that. He was young enough so that the distance didn't feel that great. And I knew where I was as a guitar player at 16, and I saw where he was at 24, and I thought, there's no way I will ever be that good. It just felt like the gulf was too huge. And in some ways, it was this experience of saying, I better find something else to do, because if I can't be that good, I don't want to bother.
That's a pretty high bar, though, to I mean, you said REO Speedwagon a few minutes ago. Nothing against, you know, those guys, Gary Richrath and you know, the guys there, and then Pat Metheny, but there's a big gap in between those two.
Right. Well, I was interested in jazz at that point. And
he's from Missouri, I think, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, he is. But that's when I think I thought about going to music school, like going to Berkeley at that point in high school. But then I started to really have doubts because I just didn't think I would ever be that good. And then you get the family pressures, you know, where, you know, they don't want you to go into music, even if you don't talk about it. Just kind of this, you pick up on it, right? Things that people say and attitudes about musicians and all that.
The conversation at the bottom of the stairs.
Yeah. And you know, you have to do something practical and something to fall back on and all that. And it's like, well, I better think about that. And especially if I have doubts about my abilities. And I've never been a very competitive person. When I found out how many guitar players were at Berkeley, I just thought, there's no way, I don't want to face that. I just don't want, I'm not that ambitious or that competitive. So,
sure.
So that's what I did. I just turned off that and didn't go to music school. I went to the University of Wisconsin my first year, but it's hard to smother your interests, right? So I was, I had a guitar and I brought it. And the first thing I did was audition for the jazz combos and big band at University of Wisconsin, where this really great bass player, Richard Davis, was teaching and was or maybe still is head of the jazz department. So I had the opportunity of taking classes with him, and that was really fantastic. So all along the way, even though I wasn't a music major, I've stayed very tethered to music. I was always practicing, trying to learn new things, trying to play in bands. So I wasn't a music major in name, but in spirit, I sort of was, I guess.
Okay. So then did you just like keep at it? And then like, did you ever get a full-time gig out of college or?
Well, what happened is my family moved to California. I switched.
Okay.
I transferred to UC Berkeley.
What prompted that? Like just job transfer or just? Okay.
Job transfer. So I graduated from UC Berkeley. Again, I wasn't a music major, but I took music classes and practiced and played it in the jazz combos. And after college, I got a job working as a legal assistant at a big San Francisco law firm. But at the same time, I was getting called to do gigs on weekends. And that kept spiraling to the point where I realized I could just quit my job and just do music, which was way more fun.
And then working in a law firm? No way.
Imagine that. Yeah. It's a hard choice.
Yeah. Oh my God. I almost went to sleep when you said that. I was like, oh my God, that is tough, man. And I was a guy that was a CPA, so out of school, so it's not much better. But my God.
Yeah. And so it was great. And when I realized, wow, I don't have to work this job anymore. I can just do music. It was incredible. I felt like I'd achieved some major victory, because I thought very few people can actually make a living at music. And here I was not only making a living, but making a good living. And I had all this extra time because I was mostly just playing on weekends. And then during the week, I had all this time. So that's when I started taking classes at a community college. I took the ear training and harmony classes, but also later on took math classes and whatnot, math and science. So working as a musician was really fantastic and is a great way to be in school, because if you think about it, most of your gigs are during the summer when people are having weddings and parties, mm-hmm. which is when you're not in school.
Right.
Then it slows down in the colder months, right around exam times. So it just seemed so perfect. It seemed like a great way to be in school and pay for yourself.
So if you were to look back at this since you've been doing it, what like advice would you have given your younger self? Is there anything, you know, constructive that you wish you would have heard that you would have done differently or that would have made your life as a musician easier?
Yeah. A couple of things, I think. One is I think I would have emphasized that now is the time to practice. Like, do it when you're young. Get the technique out of the way, because it's a little bit like learning how to ride a bicycle. I think certain technical things, if you learn them when you're young and you develop that muscle memory, it doesn't really go away. Mm. So speed and dexterity and that sort of thing. I think I would have or should have or something advised myself to work on that stuff and get it out of the way and get it under your belt, because otherwise it's going to be a struggle. So, for instance, nowadays I can practice and develop more speed, but if I don't keep at it, it evaporates. Whereas when you're young, you develop that and it becomes part of you and it kind of doesn't go away.
Yeah.
So one is basically practice more. Two is sing more. I think singing is really important, and I'm a terrible singer, and I wish I had sang more when I was younger to become more adept at that. But then three is have more confidence and recognize your strengths and your uniqueness. So I think I knew that I was a good rhythm guitar player and that I sounded good, but at the same time, I had doubts. Oh, well, I sound good doing that, but I can't play over changes very well. You know, I was always focused on the things that I couldn't do.
Sure.
And the things I could. So I didn't have, the confidence to go to music school. I just thought I wasn't good enough to compete. And I think that I was underconfident, in other words.
No, I get you. I think, man, that standard... That was tough, holding yourself up to Pat Metheny's standard. That's a tough thing.
Yeah.
And now you're playing with
the thing is,
John Scofield.
Right, which never mind. And I knew who John Scofield was at that time. As a matter of fact, he was on my radar as a guitar player way before he played with Miles Davis. Everyone knows him from playing with Miles Davis, but I knew him when he was playing with Billy Cobham and George Duke, and one of the high school bands I was in did a cover of one of those tunes. And it's like you flip over the record cover, it's, wow, this guitar player sounds really good. Who is it? John Scofield. So So
right.
That was when I was like 15 or something. In any case, I've lacked confidence my whole life.
That's not uncommon for a lot of, I think, people in the arts in general. I know certainly a lot of guys I've spoken to have really struggled with that and battled with it on a daily basis, some of them. I don't think that that's uncommon.
Right.
Let's talk about gear for a few minutes. I know you've always been the funk player, and I've seen you play Strat. I assume that's what you've played most of your career, some sort of Strat type of guitar?
Yeah. Although I modify almost all my guitars, so I kind of don't even own a Strat that's just a Strat in a way. I tinker around with it, changing the pickups and changing the switching system. And I'm a tinkerer. And that's the beauty of Fender guitars. You can take them apart easily and change things, change the necks out, change the tuners, bridge. So most everything I have is messed with. But I like the body shape of a Strat. I like the sound of Tellys, but I've always found them kind of uncomfortable. Just there's these blocks, and I don't like that it doesn't have a cutaway. I've been really into Jazzmasters, though.
Yeah, those are cool guitars, man. I like those.
Yeah, and they're really comfy to play. I love the vibrato system on them. And they really, in my experience, they stay in tune beautifully. And it's a much more subtle vibrato system than a Strat. The Strat, it's really easy to get seasick. This is much more subtle, so you can do gentle vibratos rather than dive bombs and that sort of thing.
That's the one with the arm is like very, it just hangs. It doesn't, right? It's not like stiff, the arm. It's
somewhat adjustable, but yeah, it's not very stiff, right?
Yeah.
And it's a different mechanism. So with the Strat, the whole bridge tilts on this kind of pivot.
Yep. Right?
This is a different mechanism. It's, Jazzmasters have a long tailpiece, or there's a long area behind the bridge where the strings connect, and that where the strings connect sort of moves up and down and pulls the strings back and forth. So rather than the bridge rocking, it's what's behind the bridge that moves. It's just a different system, but it depends on what you want to do. I really like them, and I like the way they feel. Also, upper note access is really easy with the Jazzmaster. But they also have a really unique tone, partially because of the way the strings break over the bridge and also because of the pickups. But I have two Jazzmasters. One has humbuckers in them, so that's not exactly a Jazzmaster. It's sometimes called a Jazz Blaster, I think they say. You have a Jazzmaster with humbuckers in it. But it still sounds a lot different than a Les Paul or something. And then I have another straight Jazzmaster, but that again is fairly modified. I had this guy put in a noise canceling circuit. Normally Jazzmasters are incredibly noisy. I think of all the single coil guitars, they can be the noisiest when you're in an environment with a lot of RF interference.
Yeah. I saw those noises. The red one, you talking about the red one?
Yeah. Yeah. The red one.
Yeah. I saw the noiseless pickups on that on your...
They're not noiseless pickups. It's the regular Jazzmaster pickups, but there's this guy in LA named Illich who has a company called Illich Electronics, and he came up with a dummy coil system. So there's a noise canceling coil that for most of his designs is embedded in the pick guard. So for instance, let's say you've got a Strat, you get his pick guard, which has a coil embedded in the plastic. And then that gets wired up to your volume knob or your circuitry in the Strat. And what it does, it's a little bit like adding a second coil to your pickup. But since the coil is so much larger than the pickup, you don't need as many winds to cancel hum. But since there's not as many whines, it doesn't interfere with the sound of the other pickup. I guess it's a little complicated to explain, but the basic idea is you're putting in a second coil to work with your single coil, but the second coil cancels hum but doesn't affect the tone. And it's a really fantastic system. In any case, he doesn't make the canceling system for Jazzmaster. So what I did is I sent him the guitar body, which he routed and put the noise canceling coil inside the guitar body.
Wow, and that's a lot of work.
It was work.
You were really committed to getting this done.
Well, yeah, because I'd done gigs with it where it was almost unusable. There was this club that I played in where every time I had my Jazzmaster there, it was hum city. It was so annoying.
Hmm.
And especially if you try to use overdrive or distortion, it just gets augmented. And it's obnoxious. You know, a little bit of hum is fine, but in this case, it was a drag and made it unplayable. And I knew about this system, so I wrote him and said, hey, is there any way you can implement this in a Jazzmaster? He said, well, there's not enough room, so I'd have to route it out. I said, fine, I'll send you the guitar body. And that's what he did. And he wired it up so that I can kick in and out this circuitry, and you can't hear a difference. There's no tonal difference. It just gets rid of the hum. So it's fantastic for Jazzmasters. In my opinion, they should all have this.
And you wouldn't just switch to Gibsons or some other humbucker?
Well, this sounds like a single. This is a Jazzmaster, and Jazzmasters have single coil pickups. So a Gibson with humbuckers would just sound totally different. Mm. And my Jazzmaster with humbuckers sounds totally different.
Okay, gotcha.
They feel similar because the body is the same and the neck's the same and all that, but they sound completely different.
So your top guitars, if I just to clarify, it's
I have a lot of guitars and I switch around and it depends on what I'm doing. For rhythm, I prefer Strats. You know, if I'm doing a straight up rhythm gig, that's what's most comfy. But Jazzmasters have a lot of character for other things. And also they're comfortable to play. But I've got other guitars. I have a George Benson hollow body that I really like.
Oh, wow. That sounds cool.
Yeah, I have a old funky harmony guitar that I like for certain things.
God, I love those. That's my next purchase. I love those, man, with those DeArmond pickups.
Oh, yeah. They're amazing. And I think a lot of it is the wood bridge. I think a wood bridge really affects the sound. Also, I have flat wounds on that guitar. And just changing the strings to flat wounds, it's like a whole other universe. And then not to mention alternate tunings, which is what I've been getting into a lot lately. And sometimes I just, honestly, I'll just go to my acoustic guitar and randomly turn the tuning pegs and then kind of see where it's at and then move it sharp or flat, whichever way it needs to go, sort of nudge it. And then it's just in some other tuning and all of a sudden it's like a whole new instrument. Of course, I have no idea where any of the fingerings are. You just start playing and you stumble on things that are just gorgeous sounding and unique that you would never be able to do in standard tuning. It has its own timbre and it gets you out of your cliches. I mean, you might finger things in the same way, but it sounds completely different.
Sure. So that's actually a smart thing to do.
Yeah. And it's really refreshing. You know, it gets really boring it gets boring hearing yourself sound like all kinds of other guitar players, but you throw it into a different tuning and all of a sudden it's a sound you've never heard before.
Well, it's just a new prompt that will generate new things because it's a new prompt.
I mean, it's a little bit like that with pedals too, where you put some effects together. But at this point, everyone's got these giant pedal boards and everyone's using the same effects that it's almost hard to find anything novel. And if you think about it, what new effects have there been since the 80s? Maybe the whammy pedals in the 90s, but this is like 20 years ago. And essentially, we're using the same things that have been used since the 60s with the wah-wah and the fuzz.
Overdrive, distortion, various slicings of that.
Yeah, and there's there's not much new you can do, so it gets a little repetitive. But you throw it in some other bizarre tuning, and all of a sudden, now this is novel.
Avi, if I asked you to pick your top three Desert Island discs in no particular order, and knowing this can change tomorrow, what would be the first three albums that come to your mind right now?
John McLaughlin's Shakti record called Handful of Beauty. That was in his phase where he was studying Indian music and had Indian musicians playing with him. And it's an astounding record.
Do you play a lot of stuff like that, Indian stuff?
No. I mean, every guitar player, I think, likes to mess around with that or try to emulate a sitar at some point.
Mm.
But no, I mean, not really. But in any case, I love that record and I love that Shakti period. It's my favorite of his. Let's see, the Pat Metheny group record, the White record. Now, honestly, I haven't listened to that in ages because I wore it out, but that was a seminal record for me. And then, geez, what else? This is an impossible question, but I'll just say...
just for today.
Okay. Rufus, Ask Rufus, that record. I loved Rufus when I was a kid and still do. And Tony Maiden, the guitar player in Rufus, was just phenomenal.
That's interesting. So that's exactly what you're playing today. You're playing funk and you're playing jazz. And so this is your roots of all this, man. Very cool.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to ask you three more questions, and I appreciate all your time, man. First question is, tell me something about yourself that people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
I'm a news junkie.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I love reading news and keeping up on current events, and probably nothing. Well, aside from playing a great gig, I love having political discussions with people.
Well, I thank you very much for not sharing them on Facebook, though.
Yeah. I heard a good quote yesterday that social media amplifies the asshole in people.
Oh, yeah. I don't know, you know. No, but I think it's the people amplifying, you know. It's like, you know, it's great that you feel this way, you know, but it's just weird. Like, you know, years ago, I'm older than you, probably, I don't know how many years, maybe call it 10, maybe more. But I would never meet someone and like start, like, or even be interested in their political views or my, and just like randomly discussing shit, you know, if it came up. Yeah. But it wasn't it wasn't like a topic of like, oh, we're not going to talk or, you know, we're going to get really, I don't know. It's just weird. Social media has amplified when people spout about all that stuff, I always wonder, is this what they're like in person?
No
matter what side they're on. Like if you met them and said, you know, for lunch, is that what their dialogue would be?
No. I don't know why, but I guess maybe it's the cover of writing or this feeling. I'm not sure why it is, but people are not the same on social media a lot of times. And in general, everyone's far more reasonable in person.
Thank God.
Yeah, thank God, right, no matter their political view. So
yeah.
So no, I don't find it very useful to spout on Facebook or anything. Occasionally I'll post an article that I think is really good or thought-provoking.
Mm.
But even then, it's like, why? I mean, I'm not some notable person that people look to for this kind of guidance. So... Yeah, so I don't post that often, and I don't like to get in. There have been a couple of times when I've gotten embroiled in online discussions, and usually I just stop. You know, if it gets too heated, I just don't respond and just kill the discussion by not participating anymore, even though I may have started something. But yeah, it's not usually very helpful, but I do enjoy actual conversation at dinner with people.
So you're a news junkie. Now, fake news junkie or real news junkie? We have to qualify this. I'm just winding you up, man. The whole thing is just cracks me up. And that's cool.
Was that your question? What's something surprising? I guess yeah. That might be surprising.
No, that's not real. That's pretty normal. I think the fact that you make apps, that was actually pretty surprising. And now that I think about it.
Yeah. And that I've kind of woven in and out of the professional music scene. Like some years, that's my main source of income. And then other years, not. And I'm lucky that I can kind of weave in and out of that. And I can pick and choose the gigs I want to do and do the music I like. For the last 10, 15 years or maybe longer, every gig I've done, I really like.
That's great, man. And I think it's really great that you give yourself permission to do that and don't like get hung up on, oh man, I got to do this full time or I'm not real or some other, you know, self-imposing limitation instead of, you know, it sounds like you're just enjoying yourself, which is, yeah. God, that's the best thing to do.
And also because I'm not so dependent on it, I can tell people if they call me for a gig where I don't think I'm the right person.
Right.
Rather than just thinking, oh, I really need the money. I think, is there someone better for this gig than me?
Sure.
And since every once in a while I'll get called to do a jazz gig, it's like, you know, I know you think I'm a jazz player, but I'm really not. And I'm not going to sound that great. You should hire someone else. There's so many other people who will do a better job than me. And here's some names. If I feel like I'm right for the situation, sure. And also, I don't feel happy if I'm doing a gig where I can't hang.
Yeah, of course. Nobody.
Yeah. So, but in any case, I do feel super fortunate to live in New York and know the musicians I know and play in the bands that I play in because they're all great. And I really look forward to all my gigs.
And you moved to the city for the Schofield gig?
Essentially, yeah. I didn't move here originally. First of all, I didn't know how long it was going to be going on. And it, you know, 5 months turned into years. So I didn't move here till about 3 or 4 years into playing with Schofield.
Okay.
But I was spending so much time in New York, it just made sense to move here. And I was also developing a lot of musical connections and a social network. So it made sense rather than flying across the country all the time and staying in New York to just move here. And it felt like a good life change.
You feel at home there?
Yeah.
Dude, what's your favorite New York City food? I'm always curious about that. Or foods.
Well, last night I went to a place called Spicy Village in Chinatown, which is outstanding.
You know what I love about Chinatown? You could eat literally, and I don't eat, I'm like normally eating super healthy and I just don't eat a lot. I eat often, but you could eat like a farm animal for like $7 or something like that in Chinatown. And there's 20 great places to choose from.
Yeah. There's also some places around me where they have specific things that I really like. Like one place has a burger that is outstanding, you know, and I'm not a big meat eater. As a matter of fact, mostly I'm vegetarian, but when I go out, I'll eat meat. It's hard to say. There's just different items I like at different restaurants.
Do you know Noodle Town?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. I went there with my kids one time. We were in the city and they got these giant, I don't eat like this. They did giant fried, like, this is like a Jiffy Pop, except four times the size of fried noodles. I've never seen anything like that in my life.
Nice. Yeah, I know Noodletown is pretty close to where I live. But yeah, Spicy Village. I'd give it a big thumbs up.
I will try that next time I'm in town.
Yeah.
And man, one last question, and I really appreciate your time. What's been the biggest change in your personality, Avi, over the last 10 years? And how much of this change has been deliberate and how much is just a part of aging?
No, honestly, I don't know. I think personality change can be very subtle and slow moving, and it's really hard to rewind and really put yourself back to where you were. I think I'm probably a little more patient than I used to be. I used to be a little more antsy and perhaps irritable, and I'm a little mellower, I think, with certain things. Yeah. I think also in a negative way, I think as you get older, when you've been exposed to music, it takes more to really get you going. In other words, things that might have really moved you in the past don't quite move you as much because you've heard it before. And so the musical universe starts to shrink or something, and it takes more effort to bust out of that universe to feel the novelty and the rush that you used to feel. So that's not such a great thing, but it's a fact of life, at least for me. But I still really get charged by music. Maybe it's just not as often, but the intensity is the same when it happens.
I wonder if that's because you're a musician and because you're just, it's, you know, that's what it's on, you know, you're on with that all the time.
Could be. Yeah. You know, I know that for me and for a lot of musicians, when you're on tour playing music all the time, a lot of times you don't want to listen to music. You want to hear like talk radio or something. It's because there's music circulating in your head so much, and you're so saturated that you need to mix it up and recharge in a way by not listening to music. So
I consistently hear that. And in fact, sometimes when I'm interviewing someone and they're on tour, I'll always, but listen, I know you're on tour. You're really busy. Thanks very much. And they always like, no, thank you. Now I only have 22 hours of the day left to kill or something like that, you know? So I totally get that. I've heard that all very consistently. Everybody, it's like, you know, you need to, it's like working in a bakery, I guess, when, you know, and you just, the last thing you want to do is look at baked goods.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I totally get that, man. Hey, man, thank you for everything. I want to tell people where they could find you and check you out and hopefully come see you on tour. First of all, it's Avi Bortnick, AviBortnick. And his website is avibortnick.net. And you could see all his gigs on there and where he's playing. And he's generally playing, unless you're out on tour with Schofield, you're generally around the city area. Tri-state area?
Occasionally I do other road gigs, but right now there's nothing coming up. But I do play locally a lot with different people. You can find my gigs on my website, my Facebook page too, which I think is Avi Bortnick Guitar or Guitarist. Sorry, I can't recall. But you can find me on Facebook if you search. My band Ola is probably going to be recording in the fall. So there's always things coming up, and I'm always trying to figure out my next move and figure out some new tuning system for the guitar to find something novel.
And your apps, and I'll restate what they are, but they're available on the iTunes store on Android?
Yeah. The Time Guru is available on Android. The others are iPhone only.
Okay. So Time Guru, which is the metronome that stops and then picks back up again. So you could train yourself to make sure that you're on your, you're on point rhythmically, and then Echo Pitch and Vox Beat are available on iTunes. Avi's also got a solo record called Clean Slate that's available, I'm assuming, on the Apple Store, on iTunes, and on your website as well.
Yeah, and I think you can stream it if that's your thing.
And if you want to get some lessons, Avi also does lessons on Skype, or if you're in the city in person. He's a phenomenal. I know you said you're not a jazz player, but he's a really good jazz player, and he's a great rhythm guitarist. I mean, you're most well known for your work with Schofield, but I would say that that's great, because if you look at all that stuff, it sounds wonderful. So that's not a bad thing to be known for by a long shot. And if you're interested in lessons with Avi, contact him again on Facebook or through his website, avibortnick.net. Man, any final words of wisdom?
Practice.
There you go. And go to Spicy Village when you're in the city. Hey, man, I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Craig.
Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks again to Avi Bortnick for spending time with us. Please check him out online and come see him on his gigs and say hello to him. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com, sign up to our newsletter list now. And remember, most important is that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.